the renewal of the Lansing School District's non-homestead millage passed soundly yesterday, 75% or so supporting. Peter Spatafor, president of the Lansing School Board and a supporter of the renewal, who was on this program yesterday, called it a great vote of confidence from the community in a tweet last night. And Peter Spatafor was on the show Monday, I beg your pardon. A great vote of confidence from the community last night from Mr. Spatafor. A proposed $1.95 million increase in property taxes in Grand Ledge was narrowly defeated, according to the Lansing State Journal. That measure would have raised $60 million or so for a variety of initiatives in Grand Ledge, but it went down. Later this hour on Current State, we're off to Owosso for the reopening of the Lebowski Center. That's coming up in just a few minutes. And this week on Neighbors in Action, we talk with a couple of representatives from Lansing's Northwest Initiative, the neighborhood organization, about all of the work they do, and it is a lot of work. From the top of our program today, the Center for Michigan yesterday released the results of a seven-month survey of people across our state. The report, issued in conjunction with Bridge Magazine, is called Michigan Speaks, a Citizen's Agenda for the 2014 Elections. It compiles the results of thousands of conversations into what they hope will spur debate during this year's elections. What topics do the people of Michigan most vigorously want their politicians to address? Well, joining us on Current State to talk about that and what it might mean to the political process this year is Amber DeLind. Amber's outreach director, director with the Center for Michigan. Amber, welcome.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Let's start with some basics. The Center for Michigan is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and your idea here is to encourage a focus on these issues that citizens brought up. It's the fourth time you've done a survey like this, and as an example of how it's been used in the past, the center sponsored the only gubernatorial debate in the 2010 election. Did you employ that survey's findings in the 2010 election?
Absolutely. Actually, the candidates in that debate debated some of the issues that were within the pages of that report.
Are you pursuing another gubernatorial debate this year?
This year, I don't think we're planning to host another debate, but we do plan to do numerous candidate engagement events throughout the summer, as well as the fall, and we're hoping to invite Michigan residents to attend some of those events.
Well, explain the methodology of the survey, please. I know you connected with a lot of citizens in a variety of ways.
We did. So this particular round of public engagement included talking with Michigan residents in three different ways. The first and our biggest effort are what we call community conversations. These are town hall style events. They take place across the state in places like churches, community centers, bars, really a variety of places.
Bars?
Even bars.
People can get very opinionated in bars.
That is true. You have to be careful. So we hosted 166 of those community conversations across the state, beginning in late September and concluding the first week of April. We supplemented the findings of those community conversations with two large statewide phone polls. We had 1,200 people in those phone polls. And then the third option for people to participate was in an online version of our community conversation, which was hosted on our website, thecenterformichigan.net.
And altogether, about 5,500 people shared their thoughts with you. This year's survey found a focus on four main issues. Let's talk about each one a little bit. Roads, bridges, and infrastructure investment. Big surprise there.
Sure.
What did people have to say about fixing the roads?
Well, this was an interesting concept to us. I mean, particularly after this wicked winter, I think it's probably not surprising that Michigan residents have a strong interest in fixing the roads. However, what did surprise us is that when we asked Michigan residents, are you willing to pay more in taxes to fix the roads, they said yes. And that was a bit of a surprise to us, given some other findings we had around public money.
Did you get into which taxes, though? Did you go that deep?
We didn't ask specifically, you know, how they would like to fund roads. But we just asked, you know, are they willing to pay a little bit more out of their pocketbook? And people said yes.
Okay. So generally, they are willing to spend more. Education issues that came up included improving K-12 performance, high school graduation rates, and college career readiness. Can you expand on what people had to say about those?
Absolutely. So this focus on education was not surprising to the center. We actually, in 2012, had a specific round of community conversations focused on K-12 education because we had been hearing so frequently that this was such a large concern to Michigan residents. And what we heard essentially is that Michigan residents are concerned that students are, in some ways, their performance is falling behind their peers in other states and around the world. And primarily, it seemed as though Michigan residents are very concerned about students being prepared for what comes next for them, whether that be college, career, some sort of vocational or technical certificate. Michigan residents are concerned that students are leaving their K-12 education experience and not finding themselves prepared for what comes next for them.
Did the respondents say, did they say one way or the other that the state needs to increase investment? Financial investment in education?
That's an excellent question. So when we talked public money, we asked Michigan residents, is there an area of spending that you would be most, that you most want to see increased? We also asked if there is an area of spending they would most like to see decreased. The most popular spending area for increases in both community conversations and in phone polls was K-12 education, but that didn't reach a majority level. So what we're finding when we talked public money was that Michigan residents are kind of signaling a new normal when it comes to public money. They feel as though this is the amount of money we're going to have in our state for probably a while. So they're wanting our state leaders to be innovative and get creative and find new solutions for tackling some of our state's complex problems.
But I want to make sure I understand you. Are you saying that the state citizens are okay with the amount of money invested in education, but they are willing to part with more on infrastructure?
So we asked a specific question about infrastructure because we had a feeling when we designed this campaign that there was a possibility that there may be, for example, a ballot measure on road funding.
Okay.
So we asked that question specifically. We didn't ask a specific question, are you willing to pay more for K-12 education? But when we asked people, is there a spending area you would be most willing to see increases for, the largest percentage of our respondents said K-12 education.
Interesting. The third issue is also related to education. Mm-hmm. Specifically, that's college affordability. About 80% say this is an urgent priority.
Yes. We noted that college affordability is a very raw issue for Michigan residents. When we asked people in our conversations, what do you think about college affordability? They people were very passionate in their responses. They said, how can we expect our young people when they leave a college program, $50,000 in debt, for example, how can we expect them to go out and start a business or they're starting behind the eight ball? Mm-hmm. Was a comment that we heard frequently. So we found 80% of our community conversation participants, 78% of those phone polled, said this is an urgent priority for our state.
And fourth, decreasing poverty was a big issue. Mm-hmm. Even though people seemed to express this as a sentiment more than they offered clear solutions.
Precisely. And we found this was a bit of a surprise for me personally, because the center has asked about poverty in previous community conversation campaigns. And in this particular case, for the first time, poverty was considered an urgent priority across all demographic groups. People in all income groups and all worker groups and all races and ages said that this is an urgent priority to them. So it's not just people in poverty who are saying this.
Okay. And what do you make of that, though?
I think I'm, to for me, my personal takeaway is that, despite the fact that Michigan seems to be at least making some gains after our Great Recession in our state, I think people are still very acutely sensing that our state is recovering, but perhaps more slowly than they would have hoped, and that there are a lot of people that are still feeling the pains of that recession, and that to grow as a state, we all have to see some success, not just some.
Our first guest today on Current State is Amber DeLand. Amber is Outreach Director with the Center for Michigan, and we're talking about the center's brand new Michigan Speaks, a citizen's agenda for the 2014 elections, the result of 5,500 responses to to questions from the Center for Michigan about what Michigan's biggest issues are. Did raising the minimum wage come up? That's certainly out there. That's in play.
Absolutely. So we asked a question, well, you know, what level of priority does increasing the minimum wage have to you? And this public opinion here was a bit more nuanced. It did not quite reach majority support amongst Michigan residents. However, there is a significant split among demographic groups. There are some groups that certainly said, a majority of them said this is an urgent priority to them. Others disagreed. So it's not quite at majority support, but we know that it's going to be a big issue in this coming election season. So we encourage candidates to take a look at the findings around minimum wage.
You tried to gauge the mood of Michigan in general, and you found that 60% feel either good or great about the state, and they feel that things have gotten a bit better here in the last 4 years. What do you make of that?
For me, it almost felt like a sense of cautious optimism. I will speak from the conversations that I facilitated. The residents that I spoke with just generally felt as though, you know, things aren't perfect. We still have work to do in our state, but it seems as though the mood, even compared to when I was facilitating conversations in 2012, is somewhat improved. People are feeling as though there are possibilities. The economy is improving.
Is that good news for the Snyder administration and incumbents in the legislature?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think it's the mood is somewhat improved, but there's also these big citizen agenda items that Michigan residents want to see addressed. So I guess November will tell us.
Well, there's more. There's more than one wolf hunting proposal related after yesterday.
That's what happened at the Capitol.
So there's a lot of ballot action as well. What's next with the survey? I know copies have been delivered to all the sitting legislators and are being sent to everyone who's filed to run for office this year. You're hoping these community conversations continue between now and the election?
Absolutely. So from now all the way through November, we will be hosting some community and candidate engagement events. And I encourage anyone listening to check out our website, thecenterformichigan.net. We'll be posting all of these opportunities on our website. We'll be doing these throughout the state, and hoping that Michigan residents will join us in asking candidates how they plan to carry out their agenda.
In the past, how would you gauge the effectiveness of your survey? Have politicians in the past focused on the issues that the center has raised?
They really have. I mean, it's been an incredible thing to be part of. In previous community conversation campaigns, we've actually seen policy change be at least in some way sparked by the findings of these reports. For example, our last public engagement campaign, which focused on K-12 education, one of the big takeaways was Michigan residents wanted to see more investment in early childhood education programs, high-quality early childhood education programs. And Michigan actually led the nation in expanding funding for the Great Start Readiness Program last year in last year's budget. And as of the writing of this report, it looks as though there's a possibility that there will be even more expansion and funding for that program. So we know that Michigan leaders are listening.
Amber DeLinde is with the Center for Michigan. You can find the center's Michigan Speaks, A Citizen's Agenda for the 2014 Elections online at the Bridge Magazine website. That's bridge-mi.com. Thank you, Amber.
Thank you, Mark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. 7 years ago, a fire badly damaged the Lebowski Center, home of the Owosso Community Players. A major refurbishing project has been completed, and on Friday night, there's a grand opening gala to celebrate the completion of work. Current State Scott Pohl spent some time in Owosso to see how things have turned out. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I am well. It sounds like an exciting moment in Owosso.
Well, it really is. Now, the fire at the Lebowski Center occurred on the night before Valentine's Day, and a lot of work and a lot of fundraising to pay for that work has culminated in its reopening. The people with the Owosso Community Players are revving up for Shrek the Musical over the next couple of weekends. I talked with a few people involved with the Owosso Community Players, starting with Linda Keenan. Linda's a past executive director, and she served as a rebuild consultant. We started by stepping outside to the spot where she stood as that awful fire raged 7 years ago.
We did drive down here. It was a terrible, terrible evening. There was a big snowstorm going on. By the time we got down here, the entire stage house was in flames, and as the evening progressed, the roof of the auditorium caught on fire, and it was emotionally very difficult moment for all of us.
Now, Linda, you and I are across the street from the building right now. This is the spot where you stood and watched the fire.
It was very emotional. We've spent so much time in the theater. It would be like your old school burning or a church burning. It was very emotional. Of course, we're theater people. We're prone to that anyway.
So this refurbishing job, it's 7 years since the fire. Were there delays along the way? Why did it take 7 years?
It takes a while to raise that much money.
So it's money, not the mechanics of
Correct.
Cleaning out the mess and starting with new construction and so on.
There were three phases. First was demolition, which took probably 6 months. And then we did fundraising, and we finally, at the end of 2010, were able to put up the walls and the roof.
How much money are we talking about?
In total, $6
million. Oh, my gosh. What sorts of things did you do to raise that kind of money?
Well, this community was very generous to us. And we also received some grants from as far away as Midland and Jackson. And we also were able to have a certain number of tax credits, new market tax credits, historic tax credits, and historic tax credits and brownfield tax credits.
Well, Linda, let's cross the street and go inside.
Okay.
Ah, that new carpet smell.
Yes,
Linda.
And you will smell paint, too.
Oh, I'm here for the paint smell. Nice. Thanks. I should have waited a couple of days. So, Linda, this would be the lobby with this beautiful floral carpet. Tell me what kind of shape this part of the building was in after the fire.
There was a lot of water damage. The fire did not reach this part. Part of the renovation is this carpet. Is a modification of what the 1926 carpet was. The lobby has been expanded, so it's at least half again as large as it was before. We focused our money on two elements. One was things to improve our performances, and you will see as we get closer to the stage how we did that. The other one was audience comfort, and this enlarged lobby and the comfortable seats are part of that.
Well, we'll see those comfortable seats next, maybe.
You will indeed.
Linda, we've walked into the theater and we're standing on the stage, and here's what I notice. We're looking down at an orchestra pit, so I'm going to be very careful. And the seats are extremely colorful. Now, why did you choose to have the seats in such a variety of colors?
Well, our architect saw this at one of the theaters in Minneapolis, and he really liked it. And so he suggested that we do that. And as you'll notice, the rest of the theater is pretty plain. It's gray and charcoal. And this actually brings some pop of color, lots of pops of color, actually, into this space. The other thing I'd like to point out is you see those five lights that are underneath the balcony there. Those also were the original 1926 lights that were renovated.
Has your capacity changed here with the refurb job?
When the theater opened in 1926, it had a seating for 1,200, but everyone was much narrower at that point in time. With the enlargement of the lobby, this theater will seat very comfortably 500.
One thing I want to point out, as I look at the proscenium arch here, I see some exposed brick over here. I see what would appear to be bare wood that probably was inside the wall. Have we preserved, other than being painted over, some of the damage from the fire here?
Absolutely. We wanted this theater to reflect the history of the building. So we have the 1926, we have the 1950 renovation, and we have examples of the damage that was done by the fire.
Now, I assume as I look up that if I was here a few days after the fire, I'd be looking into the sky. Would I be right about that?
Yes, you would.
For people who aren't around Owosso much, what happened between the fire and this reopening in terms of any stage productions anywhere? Was there theatrical activity in Owosso during that interim?
Yes, there was. As a matter of fact, the night of the fire, we were 1 week out of performances for Beauty and the Beast. All of our costumes were destroyed in the fire. Our set pieces were destroyed in the fire. This community came together, and 1 week later, we opened at the middle school with a full-fledged performance of Beauty and the Beast. And in a large part due to the community of community theaters throughout Michigan who called us and said, we just did Beauty and the Beast. We have Belle's Dress and we have this and that. It was really outstanding. And we never stopped producing shows after that. We did a number of them in the middle school. And most recently in the last few years, we have been doing them in the smaller version of the studio theater next door.
I'm Ryan Bladzik. I'm the executive director of the Owosso Community Players.
Talk about the future of the theater. People may hear theater who aren't from Owosso, for instance, and they think that all we're talking about is theatrical plays and so on. Is the building serving other purposes in this community?
Absolutely. When you have a state-of-the-art, brand-new 500-seat theater that's had as much work and care put into it, the community theater is just one of the many uses that we anticipate for it. We're able to host booked shows, concerts, community groups. If you can put it on a stage, we want to have it here because we aren't just a theater. We're an entertainment venue for the community and for the region.
As you talk with people in the community, I would assume that excitement is building about the reopening. Can you tell me about how this community supports this building, this theater, how this community rallies behind this facility?
Absolutely. Obviously, through the rebuild process, the community needed to give support just on the financial and the funding aspect. And we have had an outpouring of support, both in terms of volunteers, donors, business partners, promotional partners, and from not just Owosso, but the entire county, and like I said, beyond, into areas like Lansing, Flint, all the way up even to Mount Pleasant. And that was one of the things that was necessary for the success of the theater going out, was that there was a swell of community support for the rebuild, but then also for all the programs and the entertainment that we'll have.
My name is Garrett Bradley. I'm the artistic director of the Owosso Community Players.
How long have you been involved with the company here?
I've actually been involved with this group about 20 years. I started on this very stage when I was about 10 years old and got the theater bug then. I was heavily involved with this group through high school, and then after I graduated, I moved on and performed, traveled the world for 10 years performing. I was actually on a cruise ship the day the fire burned down. I'll never forget that. And so I started to come back occasionally to direct a guest show, and then the opportunity presented itself. And so in January, I moved from New York back to Owosso to join my second family and start this journey with Lebowski Center.
And here we are kicking things off with Shrek the Musical. Were you involved with choosing Shrek to open the Lebowski Center?
Partially. The group chose the show in the fall, last fall, and I was in town and offered some suggestions, but it was chosen by our board of trustees and our production committee before I was a staff member here.
Well, tell me about staging Shrek here. Everybody knows the story from seeing the movies, and people have seen the stage production of it. Tell me about bringing Shrek here to Owosso.
Yes, it is a beast of a show. It's a massive show, but that's part of what makes it so exciting. We felt that the most important thing is about this first show is it needed to be a show that people of all ages would love. We have a whole demographic of families that have never been in this theater before, and our community was lacking that for children. So we picked a show that we knew kids would love and adults would love. And we also wanted to make a splash. We had this grand facility, and we wanted to do something big and ambitious. And it has been a labor of love. Not only putting the show up, but, you know, learning our tech systems has been a challenge, but it's also been a great bonding experience. The amount of people that are here every single night giving all their time to this project to make it a success has been wonderful.
So what's here after Shrek?
We have an ambitious summer and fall lined up. We have a play. This summer we'll be doing Robin Hood, and it's a grand play as well. But we also have a mix of acts coming in this summer. We've got the Meridian Community Band coming over here. Ryan DeHughes, a local celebrity who's toured nationally, he'll be here performing a concert. So we have an endless, and then moving into the fall, we've got a large scale, I think, regional premiere of a musical that everyone will know coming here. And it's only going to get bigger from there. We're offering everything from musicals, plays, concerts, you name it, we're going to do it.
Linda Keenan, Garrett Bradley, and Ryan Bladzik of the Owosso Community Players. The Lebowski Center in Owosso reopens on May 9th with Shrek the Musical. Good luck, welcome back, and thank you very much for your time, all of you.
Thank you, Scott.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
It's Wednesday and time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, when we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we feature Northwest Initiative, which offers an array of programs and services to improve the health of neighborhoods on Lansing's west and northwest sides. Here to tell us more, Executive Director Peggy Vaughn Payne and Daryl Alexander, a former client and current volunteer at Northwest Initiative. Welcome to Current State.
How you doing?
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for inviting us.
It's great to have you here. What is the overall mission, the overall goals at Northwest Initiative, Peggy?
The overall goals is to really help our low to moderate income populations to have a better community, more vibrant community, and to improve the overall health and quality of life for our residents.
Daryl, you're currently a volunteer at Northwest Initiative, but you came to the organization as a client. Tell us about how you arrived at the agency.
I arrived at the agency after I was released from prison. I deal with the program Arrow, and it's a very supportive group of people that help ex-offenders transition back into society to be productive citizens in the community.
Okay. How much time did you spend in prison?
I spent 17 years in prison.
17. And specifically, how did Northwest Initiative help you?
When you come, they do an intake, and they do an assessment of your needs. Where are you at? Where you want to be? What are your goals, your aspirations, how you can get there? They have a resume building. They have job searching. They go out and canvass the community, see what different types of businesses may hire ex-offenders. Mm-hmm. They have support groups. They help you with transportation. They have various different programs that's essential when you're coming out of prison, especially after a long term, so you can transition back into the community and be productive.
Is Arrow a high priority? I mean, I know you do a mm-hmm. lot of things at Northwest Initiative, Peggy. Is Arrow a big part of the...
Arrow has grown tremendously since we started that program back in 2007. So it was an outreach of our outreach program. And so it has grown considerably. We're actually seeing now between 300 and 500 ex-offenders every year serving them.
Between 300 and 500?
Yes.
And wow. And an Arrow stands for what? ARRO?
Yes. ARRO stands for Advocacy, Reentry, Resources, and Outreach.
Daryl, coming out of prison, what did you need help with the most?
The most, three of the basic things that coming out of prison helps a person to transition successfully is food, clothing, and shelter.
Okay. The basics.
Yes.
Okay. What would you have done without this help?
Had a harder time in succeeding. I'm scheduled to get off parole June 5th, and I've been down there volunteering the entire time. I help with food distribution, canvassing. Arrow has a prison poetry project. We also do the advocacy part down at the state capitol, far as juvenile life for Bill. Monica Janner, she does a tremendous part in networking with other different organizations. I just did a atonement project with MSU and U of M.
Given the fact you are an ex-inmate, I mean, do you connect, and you serve an awful lot of this population, you connect with a lot of the people getting out of prison as well?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Peggy, tell us about some of your other programs other than Arrow. I know you work on food systems development. What is that?
So our food systems development is all about helping our residents, our target population of low to moderate income residents, access fresh, healthy fruits and vegetables. And we do that through our garden-based nutrition education program. We're in 4 schools. We teach over 1,000 students each month and about gardening and nutrition. And each of the schools has their own children's garden. And so the children are, you know, selecting what they want to grow and maintaining it. During the summer, we have the summer garden camps, and the children are able to continue to help maintain the gardens during that time period until they come back in the fall when everything is really grown and they're able to have a harvest festival.
And I had a great time working with you a few years ago was it Luton School?
Riddle
School, mm-hmm. That's right, in Lansing, where one of these community gardens takes place. Tell us about your Corner Store project.
Well, the Corner Store project was one of the initial projects that we started in helping our people to access fresh fruits and vegetables. Since we live in a food desert, we didn't have access to a full-service grocery store. The Corner Store project was working with the Quality Dairy. We started with the Quality Dairy on Pine in Saginaw to bring fresh fruits and vegetables into that store, because that's where a lot of people shop, you know, at the convenience stores, if they don't have reliable transportation.
But you also run the Westside Farmers Market.
We have the Westside Farmers
Market. Tell us about that. Where is it?
Okay, Westside Farmers Market is located on Martin Luther King between Oakland and West Saginaw, right on the Sparrow St. Lawrence Campus Hospital. We're in the parking lot behind the medical building and next door to the North Westminster Presbyterian Church. And it's a Monday seasonal market for 18 weeks. We set up on Mondays, you know, at noon, and we tear down at 7:30. The market goes from 3 to 7. We're looking for vendors. We're looking for entertainers, you know, musicians. We have youth activities. We have we use it as a venue to go out and reach out to our populations. So we set up our tables and have our services provided on site. We also do a food demonstration so that people are able to try a new vegetable or fruit. Mm-hmm. And we survey them to expose them to new things that they may not, you know, be accustomed to. We try to make it a fun in an entertaining afternoon.
And is the farmer's market stocked by the community gardens then?
We do have the school gardens does have a booth, and so they sell their wares there, and all the monies that are made go right back into the gardens. We also have, you know, wonderful farmers from around the community and other vendors that sell, you know, home-baked goods and handmade, you know, Michigan-made items. That's all about, you know, what's required to have a farmer's market in our community, is to make sure that their handmade or homemade items.
You also have an extensive outreach program. Describe that for us.
Well, our outreach program is designed to help people access, you know, community resources. We provide a lot in our own facility. So people come to us, they can sign up for what used to be known as the Ingham Health Plan, which is now we've, you know, transitioned into the Affordable Care Act programs. But it could be Medicaid, My Child, Plan First. It could be food stamps or the Bridge Card, cell phones. Whatever an individual or family has a crisis with and needs assistance with, we're there to help them. So we do an initial intake to find out everything that they need, and then we try to provide the service and or refer them to an appropriate other organization in the community that can assist them.
It's Current State's Neighbors in Action for Wednesday. Our guests are Peggy Vaughn Payne, Executive Director of the Northwest Initiative, along with Daryl Alexander, a former client and current volunteer at Northwest Initiative. Who qualifies for your services?
Anybody who lives in Northwest Lansing. Our board just this year expanded our territory, so we now actually have our western border is Waverly Road, our northern border is Sheridan Road, our eastern border is Larch, North Larch Street, and our southern border is the Grand River. So it's a big, huge territory, and we're excited about that, but it also means that we may be having more people come to see us. So if you live in the zip codes of 48917, 48906, 48915, and 48933, you are eligible to come to our office and receive services.
That's the Northwest Initiative, those four zip codes. You also work with youth. You've got a micro business program. Tell us about that.
Excited about this. We started it last year, worked with youth ages 12 and up, and we had younger youth before, but as they transitioned and became teenagers, they really wanted to earn money. They kept saying, I need to get a job. And we were always joking with them saying, well, you know, I know you want a job, but there are not very many jobs available for children and especially young children and someone without skills. So let's think outside the box. And so we brainstormed and came up with this idea of them starting their own little micro businesses. So I researched and got a curriculum that was appropriate for teenagers. And we worked with them last year. It was 25, 30 hours of classroom training, and then we just really worked with them on starting these little businesses. So we had one student who made tutus in jewelry with his mother and sold them at the market at $20 a piece. He made quite a bit. We had another youth who baked homemade cookies and did a killing at each of our markets. We had another youth who had some Middle Eastern breads and pastries, sweets, and he made out really well as, you know, too. So we just had a wonderful variety of children who were doing some great things.
How exciting. Daryl, why did you choose to stay and volunteer at Northwest Initiative?
Well, it was a learning experience. I got to learn various aspects of different things, not only with the nonprofit organization, but also with small things like the microbusiness class. If I want to be an entrepreneur, I learn from that, baby mm-hmm. steps first. I learned, had very valuable teachings given to me, great mentors, staying positive. I don't want to be the 88% that's recidivist in the state of Michigan. I want to be the 12% that succeed. And staying positive, being focused, and having a support group that does that with me helps me.
You talked about your involvement in the Arrow program. How else do you help people served by the initiative?
Oh, I help with food distribution. I go out there, help unload the trucks, and interact with the community. I also do canvassing. Also, I'm in college right now for web design, so I kind of like just kind of troubleshoot the website and help with little IT problems.
Are there opportunities for people to volunteer, Peggy?
Oh, yes. We certainly need volunteers. Last year, we had about 350 volunteers that helped us with our variety of projects. And
I can't get over these numbers. Between 300 and 500 ex-offenders mm-hmm. and between
350 volunteers.
350 volunteers. Those yes. are some amazing numbers.
And we have wonderful people that are always there to help. And if anybody is interested in helping, we always need volunteers. So just have to give us a call at 999-2894. We love to have people volunteer with the many programs that we have.
Where does your funding come from for the Northwest Initiative?
Our major funders are Ingham County, the Michigan Nutrition Network, Capital Area United Way, the City of Lansing, private corporations, as well as private donations. And we're always looking for funding.
You have some upcoming events happening as well.
Yes, we do. So since we have some new territory, I want to make sure that all the people in the 48906 and 48917 zip codes know that we're going to have folks coming out and starting door-to-door canvassing in their more vulnerable neighborhoods. So be on the lookout. We're not trying to sell you anything. We're just really trying to help you, you know, access resources that you may not know about and that could help your family. We also have our community gardens and the summer garden camps. So the community gardens still have some space. If people are interested in learning how to garden, we teach you, we handhold you through the process. Same with the summer garden camps. They'll start as soon as school is out, and we'll have 4 different 2-week camps. They're from 9 to noon. And then we also have a low-cost lawn care program that is really one of the Arrow on-the-job training programs. And so we're really excited about that. This is our third year of offering that service to people in the community, and it's wonderful.
We have does your farmer's market open for business?
It opens on June 23rd, okay. Mondays from 3 to 7 p.m., from June 23rd to October 27th.
Okay. Daryl, where do you hope to be in the next couple of years? You talked about the you're in college for web design.
Yes.
So you'd really like to. Where are you going to school?
University of Phoenix.
Okay. Very good. Any other goals that you've got here beyond a career in web design?
Well, IT career overall. Okay. Web design is just a start. You have IT security. You have programming, programming analysis, things like that. It's very important. I learned from watching so many people come into the correctional system mm-hmm. that you have to further your education and better yourself. That's a necessity to make it in today's world. So having a support group like I got, having the chance to improve myself, that's very wonderful. And in the next couple of years, I'll be active in my community, still deal with nonprofits, and increase my education.
You intend to stay in Lansing then?
Yes.
Okay. Peggy Vaughn Payne is the executive director of Lansing's Northwest Initiative. Daryl Alexander is a former client and a current volunteer there. Thanks to both of you. Good luck.
Thank you so much for having us.
Current State could always use more nominations for our Neighbors in Action segment. We know there are people and organizations out there doing excellent work. We just don't know about them. Please help us out and tweet us suggestions at KAR Current State or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line, please, and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Current State on WKAR. Thanks for joining us here on Wednesday. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the Southern Michigan Prison near Jackson, cell block 7 housed thousands of inmates beginning in the 1930s. Prisoners had been convicted of crimes ranging from liquor law violations to murder. Soon, that same cell block will be transformed into a museum that tells Jackson's story as perhaps Michigan's best-known correctional center, at one time the largest walled prison in the world. Organizers from Jackson's Ellis Sharp Museum are hoping for a late June opening of the Cell Block 7 Museum, less than an hour south of Lansing. And the woman overseeing much of the effort joins me now. Judy Horn is the Director of Collections and Exhibits at Jackson's Ellis Sharp Museum. Thanks for joining us, Judy.
Well, thank you for having me here. We really appreciate this opportunity to talk about what we're doing.
Describe the space that you have. Describe Cell Block 7. You've got a space here that you are going to turn into a museum. How much space? Describe it for us.
You know, the first time I walked in there was just incredible. It's actually two buildings. There's a smaller building in front, Building 51. And when I first walked in there, I thought, okay, this is fine. This is good. And we walked down a hallway, and then we came to an area that was like a cell area. And this is where all of the men who came in here into that building first went into the cell to wait until they had their turn to go through the whole process, the whole prisoner processing. And then I walked down a ramp and actually entered into the cell block. The cell block itself is 25,000 square feet, and it is cavernous. You walk in there, and you look down this row of prison cells on both sides of you. There are about 515 prison cells in this cell block, and it's indescribable, and it really was so different than I thought it would be. And it was, you know, they flipped on the lights, and there's this buzzing sound, so there's a lot of sensory stuff going on, and it's just, every time I go in there, it's just, I'm in awe of the space and what it's like. So it's really quite an experience to go in there.
How many stories is it then?
There are five stories. The first one, the base area, and then there are four galleries above that. And each one has, I believe, 103 cells.
You'll have 515 cells were a part of Cell Block 7. Will visitors be able to see what used to be occupied prison cells?
Oh, definitely, definitely. In fact, some of the cell doors will be open and people can actually step inside and experience what it would be like to be in that space.
Will they be enhanced to look as if they're occupied, that kind of thing? What about common areas?
Some of them, excuse me.
Some of them. Some of them, yeah. What about common areas like dining spaces? Do you have outdoor spaces to work with?
Mm-hmm. There was a dining space in there, and there I think they had seating for, I don't know, 140 some or something like that. And they're little square tables with a little stool on to the on the floor, you know, for each space.
Okay.
And there is outdoor space. Hopefully we'll have that open eventually so people can see it. The part of the prison that we're going to be in, the yard outside of that, is now not being used. But when you look out there, you get the sense of what it would have been like to be there. There's still a row of telephones there that you can see that the prisoners were able to use. And, you know, the there are many fences and gates, and the razor wire is all there. And it's very interesting to see. And it's
And cell block 7 was a working part of the prison until fairly recently.
Oh, yeah,
correct?
Until 2007.
2007, yes, cell block 7 was still in use. Mm-hmm. Jackson's got a long history as a correctional town. The first state prison began there, I think, opened in 1837. And you,
correct.
Mm-hmm. And you speak in terms of the old prison and the new prison.
Yeah, and that's how we refer to them in Jackson. And it's kind of strange when you think about the new prison is, you know, was actually built in the 1920s and had prisoners in it by, you know, sometime late in the 1920s and was open in the 1930s, but it's still the new prison in Jackson. But the old facility opened in the 1830s. It started out as a very small facility and was built of tamarack trees. And the prisoners were in these wooden buildings and were shackled with ball and chain to the rails at night, mm-hmm. so that they couldn't escape. But plenty did, trust me. There are lots of interesting stories about escapes.
Are you going to be telling some of those escape stories at the prison?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the actually, we're going to have some spaces where the stories will change. When you come to the museum, you'll see that some of the stories stay the same because they're important to keep going. A lot of the history, but we want to make it new and fresh for people to be able to have something different to look at. We hope that we have a lot of return visitors, so some of our exhibit spaces will change. And one of the first exhibits that we're going to do is about the famous helicopter escape. And that's
which
really,
I remember. Yeah, 1975.
Correct. And he was a repeat offender as far as escapes go, and this was his third escape. And he was in prison for all sorts of different reasons, from stealing $40,000 worth of hogs to larceny and all sorts of things over the years. And he never stayed very long. He always managed to find a way to get out. His name was David Otto, I believe. Yes, that was his name. And his last escape was the helicopter escape, and apparently there was a gentleman who hijacked a helicopter and landed it near the workspace that he was working in. And
this was inside
the prison.
This was inside.
Landed.
Oh my
God. Landed his helicopter. He got in there, and he wasn't gone for very long before he was back again, and eventually ended up in prison in Illinois, I believe. And then he, after his last time in prison, he opened a ranch here in Michigan, I believe. Then eventually retired to California.
Okay.
And lived there till he was about 71.
How interesting. Mm-hmm. I know you're on a search for items from the prison to place in the museum.
Yes.
How is that search going?
Actually, it's going well. We've had a lot of calls. People have been very supportive of this, and we've had a lot of calls. We want stories. We want artifacts that we can find, uniforms, letters, anything made at the prison. There were several factories over the years in the prisons, lots of things made at the prison throughout time, and there was a wonderful hobby shop. So we've gotten quite a few things in from the hobby shop, some leather purses, a beautiful little piano jewelry box made out of matchsticks, and just all sorts of incredible things.
We're talking with Judy Horn. Judy's the Director of Collections and Exhibits at Jackson's Ella Sharp Museum, and she's a lead person on the new Cell Block 7 Museum, which is a part of the Southern Michigan Prison near Jackson. Cell Block 7, of course, a functioning part of the prison up until 2007, but it will become a museum. It's scheduled to become a museum the end of next month. The rest of the complex is still a working prison.
Yes,
here.
It is.
Mm-hmm. How many inmates are incarcerated there today?
Currently about 6,800.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do other established prisons have museums? I mean, are you really cutting edge here?
I believe we are, because we're going to be the only museum open in an operating prison. So this is very unique, and we're excited about the about the prospect of this?
I was at the museum. I was at the prison the day Jack Kevorkian was released, which
really?
Is actually, which is now that I think about it, is just about 7 years ago, almost to the week.
Really?
There have been others. I mean, you told the story of the helicopter escape. What's another story related to the prison that you know you want to tell in the museum?
The story of the furniture factories that were in there in the early years of the prison. We're going to tell the story of Albert Ewart, who was a chaplain at the prison and later worked in the probation area. And what's fascinating about him is he was really an important part of rehabilitation for prisoners and did a lot of things with that. You know what? I'll tell you. When we first were approached about this and I started thinking about this, I sat down one day and I had a 3-page typed out list of just different ideas of stories that we could tell at the prison throughout the years. And that list has grown and grown. So there are so many things that we can talk about.
Well, we look forward to it a lot. We'll be staying in touch with you.
Oh, I hope so.
With regard to the Cell Block 7 Museum, Judy Horn is the Director of Collections and Exhibits at Jackson's Ella Sharp Museum, but she's playing a leadership role here in the establishment of the Cell Block 7 Museum, scheduled to open the end of next month. And if you have any artifacts or stories or anything related to the Jackson Prison and the correctional facility down there, get in touch with Judy
at the
Ella Sharp Museum in Jackson. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Sounds like an interesting trip. That's our show for today. We encourage you to join us tomorrow here on Current State. We will be back tomorrow and on Friday. Don't forget Current State Weekend with your host, Emmanuel Berry, as well. Peter Worf is our executive producer. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.